Today's edition of the Daily Daily Caller podcast is brought to you by Ancient Life Oil.
What is full spectrum CBD? Full spectrum CBD is all the cannabinoids, which in turn gives you major effectiveness. CBD isolate is much less effective than full spectrum CBD. No herbicides, no pesticides, pure organic, non-GMO, full spectrum CBD. Where do you get the good stuff? At ancientlifeoil.com. That's ancientlifeoil.com. Buy CBD tinctures that work. That's ancientlifeoil.com.
Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Caller podcast for Friday, the 17th day of April, 2020. It's a Friday. Like I said, it's a Friday. Not that Fridays matter much anymore. It's just like every other day. But this is the interview edition of the podcast, and today we have a special guest. We actually, the audio version has two guests. The video version has one guest, which is also included in this one. So if you're hearing this intro, you're listening to the audio version, not that you need me to tell you that. I'm just slap happy, ready for the weekend. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. We're joined, going to be joined about halfway through the show by Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. She is, she's put together a bunch of public service announcements to help boost the morale of the American people in these times. We talk about that. We talk about how do we punish China? What do we do with China? Where do we go with China? There are a lot of possibilities on the table. And we also talk about how we reopen the government, what we need. Some states are ready to go. Other states obviously are not ready to go. And it's going to be a painful mess. Plus, Democrats are blocking small business loans to keep people employed on the day after we find out that another 5.2 million Americans joined the ranks of the unemployed. You would think Democrats who claim to care about the middle class would, you know, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, care about the middle class. But you'd be wrong. She's got some choice words for the Nancy Pelosi's and Chuck Schumer's of the world. We'll get into all of that with Senator Blackburn coming up. Before we get into that, we talk to Brian Darling. I haven't recorded with him yet. I'm about to, but we're going to talk about, I want to ask him, he knows Senate procedure, he knows the Constitution, and this idea that they are in pro forma session all the time. Congress isn't in session. Congress is off at home, most of them. Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy happen to be in Washington, D.C., but Chuck Schumer's up in New York, and Nancy Pelosi is off in California in one of her mansions, standing in front of a $20,000 pair of refrigerators stocked with $16 per pint ice cream, talking to late night hosts, because that's how she rolls. How are we going to get anything done? Shouldn't legislators be working? Aren't they paid to lead in trying times? You know, they're just going to have to knock off the fooling around and maybe do their damn jobs. We'll talk to Brian about that, plus the idea of the President of the United States recessing Congress that was raised on Wednesday at the daily press briefing. And it's a very interesting and constitutionally based idea. Brian knows Senate procedure. He knows how government works. He's also a lawyer. We'll talk to him about that and whatever else comes up. We're only going to spend about 20 minutes with him because we spent about 35 minutes with Senator Blackburn. But before we get to any of that, oh, by the way, you could, if you didn't listen to the Sean Davis interview yesterday, you should go back, download yesterday's podcast, and listen to it. There's a lot of great information and a new way of thinking about things, and a clear way, a data-driven way of thinking about things. Well worth your time. You can always email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. Complaints, compliments, whatever you got. Thank you for sharing on social media and spreading the word. Every one of these shows that downloads directly to your phone has a correlating post to it on the Daily Caller website that you can easily share, and I'd appreciate that. Or just word of mouth. anything you got. And as always, the website, if you want to chip in a couple of bucks, is patreon.com/Derek Hunter Podcast. All donations go towards improving the quality of the program, soundproofing this, not soundproofing, but making it so there's not an echo. It's amazing to me watching all these people on cable TV from their homes, and they choose like the echoiest room in their house. And no producer on the other end says, hey, do you have a room with carpet at least? So we at least manage to avoid that as best we can as we upgrade the microphones and the editing software and stuff. And by we, I mean me and the cats, although the cats aren't as helpful as I think they could be. But before we get to any of that, we got to give a hat tip to our awesome sponsor, CBD oil from ancientlifeoil.com. You hear about CBD oil all the time. They're being advertised all over radio, on TV. You can buy it at the gas station, the grocery store. Most of it, quite frankly, is junk. The good stuff, 100% organic, is at ancientlifeoil.com. And it is, I'm using the cinnamon right now. Really helps with, you know, headaches, backaches, knee pain, whatever it is, it helps you relax. It's not loaded up with THC, sorry stoners, but it will help you where you need help. It's amazing. Search CBD oil benefits, see what people are saying, talk to your friends. Lord knows, hopefully you're talking to a lot of people right now. See who's taken CBD oil, see who's tried it, see what they say, and then give it a shot yourself. Go to ancientlifeoil.com. They're having a huge sale right now, and you can save even more if you subscribe, but if you just want to try it once, you're still saving money. And at checkout, enter promo code Derek, click apply, you get free shipping, free fast shipping. You can't beat the deal. You'll be a believer, trust me. I am. I wasn't. And then they gave me a sample and I said, hey, wait a second. What's going on here? Okay, let's get, and don't forget promo code Derek so they know where you came from and you get free shipping. Let's get into the program. Okay, as promised, we're joined now by my buddy Brian Darling, my former, in a different life, we were golf partners and softball friends, and now I gave him a bag of gloves. That's been our last interaction. President of Liberty Government Affairs. How is week 5 of isolation going, Brian?
Hell. It's hell. I don't like it.
You let your wife cut your hair. So that's...
I know. It looks horrible, but it's nice and short. I like it. It's very manageable.
Just, you look like Pete Buttigieg. Have you seen his new haircut?
No, that's not a flattering thing to say, that I look like Pete Buttigieg.
No, he's got the same haircut. I think Chasten and your wife used the same setting on the Clippers.
Probably. And that means that he got a very short haircut too.
The difference is if he'd have won the bet, he would have been the Democratic nominee for president. Whereas if you'd have won the bet, I don't know what you would have gotten. I'm not sure, but I assume the stakes were equally as high. I didn't want to just ridicule your appearance because I've shaved. Lord knows, if you watch the Marsha Blackburn interview video, you see my, it's stubbly now, but I shaved the beard because it was time and a mask fits better. But I wanted to talk to you, Brian, because the other day, on Wednesday, the President of the United States threatened to invoke a little known, little never used provision of the Constitution to adjourn Congress. And when most people heard that, they probably thought, is this some sort of weird power trip? What the hell is the president talking about? He's not known as a constitutional scholar. And so people likely thought, is he just going crazy? Is he, you know, what is he doing? But there's actually a provision in the Constitution in Article 2, that grants the president the power to do just that. Tell us about it.
Yes, Article 2, Section 3. It's a provision in the Constitution that references a State of the Union. It also mentions the fact that the president has a power to make recommendations to Congress on legislation. But one of the little-known provisions, and one that we're all learning more about as this goes on, as the president talks more about it, is the fact that the president has a power to force Congress to convene He doesn't need a reason. He can force them to convene.
Well, we all kind of knew that, that the president could call an emergency session of Congress if they were off dithering in an August recess and something happened. I had no idea that was a two-way street, though, that he could tell them to buzz off, too.
Yeah, he can tell them to buzz off, but it, excuse me, it has to be under pretty special circumstances. It has to be a circumstance where the House and the Senate have a disagreement about when to adjourn, and that's the rub. And that's what's going to make it difficult for the president to pull the trigger if he wants to do this. Although, I mean, there are two ways to look at it. One way is a practical, you know, if he does do it and say, hey, I think that there is a disagreement, I'm just going to start doing recess appointments, that'll have to wind itself through the court. So he may actually get some of his people into office for a short period of time while this gets litigated. But the practical matter is it's possible to do it. He would need some cooperation from the Senate to actually create this disagreement on adjournment if he really wanted to do it. But the big picture problem is, why is the Senate and the House come in for pro forma sessions, basically to gavel in for 10 minutes, not even, sometimes just for a few seconds, they gavel in, gavel out for the sole purpose of blocking the president from doing recess appointments, which doesn't make much sense to me when you have the president trying to stack up his administration with people that he wants to have working for him. And for whatever reason, the Senate takes forever to transact business and get these nominations passed.
Well, let's get into that for a second. The idea of a recess appointment is important, and it's in the Constitution for a very specific reason. We used to have a part-time legislature. And so, you know, if they were meeting 3 months, 4 months out of the year, and the president needed to appoint, say, somebody resigned for, as Secretary of State or Secretary of War, as it was back in the day, the president would need to replace that person. And if the Senate wasn't in session, if they were in recess, there would be no, if they needed Senate permission, there would be no way to fill that job. So the Founding Fathers smartly put in the recess appointment, where if Congress is out, is it for 10 days? Is that what it is? For 10 consecutive days that they can then, if they don't meet for 10 consecutive days, then the president can appoint that person, and they are there till the, is it the end of the next Congress, end of that Congress, yes. Or is it the end of that Congress? So at the most anybody could serve would be 2 years as a recess appointee.
Yep, that's correct.
But under George W. Bush, when he recessed, because recess appointments weren't all that uncommon. They weren't necessary like they are now, but they weren't uncommon or unheard of. The Democrats were mad they had slow walked successfully, were taking their sweet time with John Bolton being appointed UN ambassador. So in a recess appointment, George W. Bush said, all right, I'm going to appoint him UN ambassador. Democrats hated that, and they, from that moment on, vowed to never recess again so that no appointments could be made by George W. Bush, as they still dilly-dallied on the other ones. Republicans returned the favor under Barack Obama, and they've essentially never been on recess officially, even though they've taken a month off here and there. They've never been on recess since then, which is absurd, right?
Yes, it's absurd that they claim that they are not in recess when they're not. By the time they come back in May, they're going to have been out of session for a month. They usually have an August recess that lasts for a month. I mean, that is out of session. And one of the big differences between now and when you look back to our founding fathers, when they set up our country, they didn't have the undersecretary for Near Eastern Affairs that had to be confirmed, and, you know, a Health and Human Services undersecretary for Legislative Affairs. They didn't have all the positions that are put under the confirmable positions that has happened over the years. So they didn't have to transact nearly as much business. And when you have the filibuster, which has been gutted in this, the only simple majority to pass somebody, but you still have 2 days to get somebody from actually bringing them on the floor to confirmation, it takes forever. It's a mess. It's a messy situation. They probably need to do something to fix the situation. Maybe maybe make less of the individuals that go into the federal government in confirmable positions, because it's just ridiculous that somebody would have to wait over a year just to get in their job in the federal government. Why would they want that job?
And what you're talking about is the 2 days and the process. They can, the Senate can only act on one at a time if there is an objection. So for every day you could confirm, or every 2 days you could confirm one person and then move on to the next one while conducting other business in the interim. It's not as though Democrats are using those 2 days to really make the case against somebody. They're just saying, well, we're going to make sure you use these 2 days. So 100 people being appointed, which could really be done in an afternoon for probably 90% of them, becomes a 200-day ordeal because of procedural nonsense.
That's right. I mean, it is procedural nonsense that the Democrats are using now. And hey, look, I'm 100% in favor of procedural nonsense if there's a goal in mind. But it seems like the goal for Democrats is just to obstruct 100%. Anything that Trump wants, they're going to obstruct. So the easiest thing to do is to throw down a blockade in front of all of his nominations, gives them leverage towards the end of the year where they can maybe use all these nominations saying, hey, you want all these nominees to get confirmed? You got to give us X, Y, and Z. We need, you know, some sort of legislation that we've been pushing for a while, or an infrastructure bill. We want to put more money in the infrastructure bill, and we'll give you an extra $20 billion if you give us our nominations. It's a way Congress works with horse trading, and it gives Democrats leverage, but it really screws up the federal government because your executive branch can't do their job.
And that ends up with a lot of holdovers, right? People from the previous administration who stay in those positions until their positions are filled, as a sort of the incoming administration says, all right, you're kind of an insignificant person. We don't really have anybody that's going to get in there in the next 6 months. We need somebody to do this job. Would you continue to do this job? Which opens itself up for all kinds of leaks, I would think.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, you could say it's a deep state. I mean, you've got people, holdovers from the Obama administration, basically sabotaging the Trump administration, which is, you know, there's still some ideas that are alive from the Obama years, some regulations. It's just, you do have that problem where an administration wants to have what they want to have. They want to have their people, they want their policies, and it's not right when you have a situation where the only way this Trump administration can continue to work is to keep a handful of Obama people around, or they won't have anybody to run the federal government. I mean, it's wrong. And I think Democrats agree. You know, if they perceive that they have a chance to take over next year, you're going to hear the basically the Republicans and the Democrats exchange talking points in the issue. And you'll hear the Democrats saying, oh, we can't do our job. The filibuster's horrible. We can't get any of our nominees confirmed, and Republicans will be the ones blocking it. But it shows that there's a dysfunction and a real problem with the way that the Senate is transacting business now. And it could be fixed. I mean, they could sit down and rewrite the rules a little bit to maybe make it a little bit more fair. Or they could
Or Democrats could look at the list of nominees that are held up for no other reason than the fact that they can hold them up and say, all right, we're going to let them go, but we still really don't like X, Y, and Z. We don't like these 10 people. We have objections, so we're going to not let them go. But the rest of them, we're just being dicks. So we'll let them go.
That's right. They could do that. That would be the rational thing to do if you were hoping that if you ever took over the presidency again, that the Republicans would treat you the same way and say, we're going to block the real extreme nut jobs, but you're not going to, you'll get the more moderate nominees you want in, people in lower level positions that don't really matter. But for whatever reason, that's not the way Washington works. And I don't have any confidence that rational minds will prevail. I think partisanship usually wins the day.
In your years in the Senate and in my time in the Senate, even when there were disagreements, for the most part, they liked each other, right? The members liked each other. I do remember Senator Burns telling me once that that Harry Reid was probably the most dishonest man he'd ever met. But in general, they all get along behind the scenes, and they try. They're very cordial, not only on the Senate floor because of rules, but they were cordial in real life. That, do they like it? You're up on Capitol Hill a lot now. Do you Do they like each other now? Do they get along? Is that camaraderie gone?
I think it is. I think there used to be a lot of camaraderie. I think you had a situation back in the day where I had a former boss that was friendly
Somebody's beating up your kids.
Yeah, my kid's going crazy right now. I think maybe something's upsetting him. Maybe he's watching the news. But back in the day, I mean, I had a boss, Senator Bob Smith in New Hampshire, who was very good friends with Senator Ted Kennedy, the late senator from Massachusetts. And on the Senate floor, you would think that they were ready to punch each other in the face the way they would talk to each other. And Kennedy would use his booming voice and yell and scream. And then right when they get off the floor, Kennedy would walk over and kind of joke around with them and say, hey, what do you think of that? And it was a different era. It was a different time. And I think members had a much more healthy idea of how politics should work. You can fight, you can scrap, you can have it out when you're actually in the field of battle in the Senate floor and arguing a case, but they actually could walk off the Senate floor and be friends afterwards, which I just don't see happening very much right now. It happens in rare cases, but it's not as pervasive. It's much more partisan now.
When senators come into office, they get a mentor senator, generally from the other party. Wasn't Rand Paul your former boss's mentor, Al Franken?
Yeah, I believe so. That was before I came on board. And so I never actually asked him how he got along with Al Franken. But my former boss, Rand Paul, had a good relationship with Kirsten Gillibrand. He had a number of friends across the aisle. He had a sit down with Cory Booker that I participated in when they were talking about criminal justice reform. He had a couple Democratic friends where he would sit down on issues, an issue here, an issue there, and talk with them and work with them on different issues. And so it does happen, but it's just rare. I feel like it happened a lot more back when they just seemed to be more comedy in the Senate. There was more friendliness where they actually were a club in the sense that they all tried to get along. Now I think it's more Republicans have their own club, Democrats have their own club, and they don't try as hard anymore. I think it's more.
What happened? Not that I when Democrats and Republicans get along, Democrats tend to win. So I'm not like lamenting it. I'm just out of curiosity. Was there a tipping point? Was there a turning point?
Well, I think with both parties, I think the moderates have been wiped out for the most part. I mean, the Democrats don't have moderates in their party. You look at the Democratic Senate, you have Joe Manchin of West Virginia, maybe Sinema of Arizona, but that's it. I mean, you really don't have the true moderates that you did in the Democratic Party back in the day, many of which came from the South. And the Republicans have, you know, they have many more conservatives now. It's a much more conservative caucus. So there just isn't as much common ground. I mean, you get guys like Mike Lee from Utah and my former boss, Rand Paul, and a couple others. There are ways they can find common ground because they're not really traditional Republicans in the sense they're more libertarian-ish Republicans, and they have a lot of common ground on a handful of issues with Democrats, but you just don't see it as much anymore. And I think part of it is the era we're in. We're in a very partisan era where these guys, not only do they fight it out in the Senate floor, but then they go on MSNBC, CNN, and Fox and battle it out. It seems like all they do is fight. There's no real opportunity to kind of get away from the glare of the lights and be friends.
I got to ask you about something that happened in the Senate last week that is now having ramifications. When Senator Mitch McConnell went down, he put forth a one or two page bill to essentially refund the Paycheck Protection aspect, the small business loans. They've run out of money. Now, it's late afternoon, early evening on Thursday. Maybe Democrats will come to their senses by the time this actually posts, but it's doubtful. It's just basically replenishing a very important and wildly successful program that ran out of money to loan small businesses money to keep people on the payroll. And in exchange for keeping people on the payroll for 6 months, they don't have to pay those loans back. So they become grants, which, you know, if you take $30,000 in loans as a small business, that means that you've got everybody who works for that company He got him a job for at least 6 months, which by which time we should hopefully be out of this. It's a way to keep businesses in business and keep people off the unemployment rolls. It's out of money. Democrats, theoretically, if their talking points are anywhere close to what they truly believe, would support this. It helps blue collar, middle class people keep their jobs. And at the end of the tunnel, you need a job waiting for you. Yet Nancy Pelosi seems to have decided to be the marionette master of Chuck Schumer and make him object. They were trying to pass it by unanimous consent. Instead, Chuck Schumer objected, which meant that it couldn't pass because there was no way to do a vote. Talk a little bit about, normally the Senate and House, they work together, but not at the behest of one another. This seems to be Nancy Pelosi telling Chuck Schumer what to do.
Yeah, and we did see a lot of that with the first, the phase three bill to respond to the coronavirus. But I'm going to take a little bit of a different position than you. I'm a little bit more concerned about the fact that Congress wants to pass a $250 billion bill by unanimous consent and just kind of say,
right.
Oh,
we want to pass. I get that, but that's not why they objected.
Right.
If Rand Paul objected because of that, I would understand it. If Mike Lee objected because of it, I would understand it. I don't know that I'd necessarily agree with it at this time under normal circumstances, absolutely. But we're trying to keep people from being unemployed and businesses from going under. Nancy wants more. She wants more money. She wants more money for what she wants money for. And if for what she's the case she's making has any merit, she should be able to make that case on its own and pass a piece of legislation to fund her projects in the House and then put pressure on the Senate to take it up rather than stop the Senate from doing something that they deem important.
That's right. They're opposing it not because it spends too much and because they're worried about the program, because it doesn't spend enough. They want more money, and they want more money for their pet projects. And we saw it in the phase three bill. I mean, the fact that the Kennedy Center got a massive bailout, just ridiculous. They loaded it up with so many ridiculous provisions that had absolutely nothing to do with the crisis we're facing. So you're right. I mean, this is something that Democrats are opposing for the wrong reason. But one of the things that I just don't understand is how Republicans have completely lost their way on spending, and the fact that we're already reading reports that the businesses, the small businesses that really need the help, aren't getting the help because the money's running out because it went to companies that didn't need as much help. You're seeing stories about people who are unemployed that can't get through. They're calling in trying to file for unemployment, and they've called 300 times and they can't get through. So these programs are not working all that great. Maybe we need to wait a few weeks, see how they work after a few weeks, try and fix the problems before we run and throw another, you know, $500 billion or whatever it's going to end up being at the program. Yes, these small businesses do need the money badly, and they probably should pass something, another bill to spend more money if that's what they're going to do. But they really need to maybe come back to town and do their job. How about fly back in and actually convene Congress if you're going to spend another $250 billion of the taxpayer money that we don't have? I mean, we're going to have a $4 trillion debt this year at a minimum. They need to do their jobs, come back in and actually debate this stuff and read the bills before they pass the bills.
Why the hell would Nancy Pelosi want to leave her $20,000 refrigerator stocked with ice cream that costs $16 a pint? You wouldn't want to leave that. Come on.
That looks good. I want to hang out with her. Her house looks beautiful.
Yeah, no kidding. She's definitely got some money there, which is part of the reason why she doesn't care. Now, like we said, like we started this, as we finished this, the president could call Congress back, could he not?
Oh, he can. He can tomorrow say, you're all coming back. But of course, you'd hear all these cries from these members saying, oh, we can't come back. We don't want to get sick. You know, it's a dangerous time. Well, how about using military aircraft? Get them in here, put them in their places, give them masks, give them everything they want to protect themselves. But they need to do their jobs because, you know, while our truckers are driving around the country, putting themselves in danger, I mean, everybody's getting Amazon packages and different packages sent to their doorstep. Those people are putting their lives in the line. You go to the grocery store, people are working at the grocery store, putting their lives in the line. yet the members of Congress who are supposed to be leaders are scared to come to Washington. That's not the way our government's supposed to work. If they're going to spend all this money that we don't have, come back and make the bill rock solid, make sure that you solve all the problems that people are complaining about before you do it, or just don't do it.
Lastly, one of the things Nancy Pelosi said that she wants added into this next thing is money for state and local governments, because they're going broke. They're taking a hit now, too. Of course, they control their own economic fates. They could open up sectors of their economy and get the revenue flowing again. But just like the federal government, even though they won't do it, shouldn't this be sort of, yes, maybe we'll help you because we screwed you, but with that has to come in dollar for dollar. You have to find ways to cut. You have to find savings, because we're all paying the price for 40 plus years of spending like a drunken sailor. And, you know, it was great. It was fun. It was wonderful. Who doesn't love to throw a giant party, but suddenly the bill shows up? It would be one thing if we didn't have a deficit of $20 trillion to begin with, where, you know, you need to spend $4 trillion to keep the economy afloat. But we did spend $20 trillion. We maxed out our credit cards, and now we need our credit cards, you know? And so shouldn't state and local governments as well be forced to take a good look in the mirror and say, okay, we really need to prioritize all the crap that we do and maybe shrink a little?
Maybe the state should be bailing out the federal government, because federal government's running out of money too. I mean, the state's saying, oh, we don't have money, we can't balance our budgets. Well, we can't here in Washington either, right? So no government's going to be able to balance their budget when the economy shut down. You have zero revenues coming in because nobody's working. Nobody's paying taxes because they don't have a job. Businesses aren't selling anything. You don't have sales taxes. It's a mess. And how's the federal government going to bail out the states? I mean, you hear, you know, New York and California talking about, you know, multi-billion dollar deficits they're running. That's another $1 trillion that we don't have. I mean, at some point, the federal government's going to run out of money, and then we're going to be in really big trouble because we're not going to have a government anymore.
And all you're doing is absolving the bad decisions that the states made up until this point. Not saying that they don't need help, and this isn't exactly ideal circumstances, but again, just like the federal government acted irresponsibly leading up to this, the state governments acted irresponsibly leading up to this. Everybody, this could be, should be a reckoning. Sadly, I think there are going to be a lot of Americans who go, what we need is bigger government. You know, that'll be the solution. That's the problem. And, you know, that's right in Joe Biden's wheelhouse.
That's right. I mean, right now, we're seeing a lot of problems with big government. I mean, look at what's happening in Michigan. You're having protests where people are saying, you're taking away all my freedoms. I actually want to go out. You know, you're seeing it in Texas and a number of states where people are pushing back against draconian rules that are making people stay inside and not go out at all. I mean, there needs to be some rationality in this. And we need to understand that the precedent being set can't continue. We can't have a situation where the powers that the government is exercising now can be exercised when this crisis passes, because then we will have lost a lot of freedom in this country.
And on that cheery note, we say goodbye to Brian Darling. Thanks for taking the time today. Not like you had anything else to do with it. And now we go right to Marsha Blackburn. All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Daily Caller podcast for Friday, the 17th of April, the video interview edition. And this time's very special. It's our first official sitting member of Congress. Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn joins us. Welcome, Senator. Thank you for taking the time.
Oh, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
I appreciate you. Let me take my glasses off to get rid of the glare here, but I appreciate you. First of all, how are things in Tennessee during this pandemic?
Well, Tennesseans are a pretty resolute bunch of people. And you say, be resourceful and figure this out. They're going to do it. They're known as the volunteer state. So our Tennesseans, even though we have had two tornadoes and the COVID-19 all in the past month, you know, we feel like that we're on the upside. We had these three big strikes. It didn't get us down and out. And we are going to hang in here and make certain we lead the way to a recovery.
It's great. Tennessee is a beautiful place. I actually spent my high school spring break in Tennessee. We just drove from Michigan to Tennessee, Gatlinburg, Ober-Gatlinburg, and all.
Sure. Yeah.
We shunned the beaches for the fun. But let's talk about a new project that you have. Because one of the things that we're seeing, and President Trump referenced this yesterday at his press conference, is the depression that sets in when people are out of work and unable to do anything about it. There's no option right now. Morale is wildly important. You are, with a help of some famous people, trying to work on the nation's morale. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yes, we are. I have some of our friends from the healthcare community and the entertainment industry, and there are a series of PSAs that they have done, and we are putting those up on social media. We just think it is vitally important to talk about what real, true strength looks like right now. That strength is doing what you ought to do to defeat this virus, doing what you're asked to do by the CDC, and practice that hand washing, make certain that you're keeping your distance, doing what you should be doing to support small businesses in the community and to help them come past this. We are all in this together. We're going to get past it together. But the thing is, we've got to show that resolve and that commitment to defeat this virus and to survive this health, food, and financial crisis all rolled into one.
One of the things that I find great about this country is the American spirit and the entrepreneurial spirit that we have here. Restaurants that never do takeout are finding new ways to service customers. The Palm here in Washington, D.C. can't serve customers, but they're selling their produce. It's like a mini grocery store. You can go and get a meal you may love, but you can make it at home. What are you seeing as far as adaptability of the American people in this time of unprecedented weirdness, I guess, for lack of a better word?
Right. And what we're seeing in Tennessee is exactly some of those things where you have restaurants that are selling their steaks or their burgers or their salad makings. You take it home and you fix it yourself, but you've got that taste and seasonings from that restaurant. You also have restaurants that have converted to takeout, and they have a daily meal to go menu. They'll send you what they're cooking that day, and then you can get it and take it home. We also are seeing companies that are changing the way their employees work. And I think there's a lot of research that has shown many of the jobs, 35% of the jobs, can be done from home. So I think you'll see a reshaping of the workplace somewhat. The other thing that has been really inspiring is the way neighbors step up to help neighbors and pitch in to go help someone who's not able to do something or to run errands for them if they're confined at home with little children and really can't get them out right now. We also have some of our retail stores. People can't go into shop, but you still have children who are growing, who need summer clothes, who need things. And so what they're doing is calling some of their customers, and then they're dropping off for those customers the things that they need. So people, you're exactly right. It is that great can-do spirit that says, I am going to do this, that is really going to pull us through this crisis and through this recession.
As a father of two kids under three, I know all about them growing like weeds.
Yes.
Luckily, thankfully, they don't have any concept of the passage of time, so they don't realize that they haven't been anywhere in over a month. But what would you say to somebody who has teenagers who are acutely, you're never more acutely aware of how long a second is than when you're really watching it, and they have friends, they have events that are being canceled. Do you have any advice for them who to find a way to pass the time of an unruly teenager. I know I was one of them.
Yeah, you know, and I've talked to a couple of people and a couple of thoughts on teenagers, but having talked to parents of teenagers, what is happening is they're doing online school in the morning. And then you've got that expansive time and parents don't want them tied to the TV. And I talked to this guy this weekend and he said he and his son were putting in a garden. His son had never done any kind of gardening. So they found an area in their yard. They were creating a garden and he was going to teach his son how to grow a salad garden. And this guy said, you know, I haven't done this since I did it with my granddad. And now this guy has a teenage son. And he said his son thought it would be pretty cool to do a garden and grow some of your own vegetables. So they were doing tomatoes and peppers and we're going to try to grow some lettuce. I said, watch out for the rabbits on that one. I'm a gardener. But, you know, I think what it is doing is reshaping some of the activities because parents don't want their teenagers locked into a video screen, nor do they want them on their phone the entire time. And, you know, I heard today one of our wireless companies is processing several billion texts per day and just under a billion telephone calls every day. And this is the volume of activity that is taking place over wireless devices. So you do want to have that opportunity to spend time with children, work out with them, walk with them, read a book, play games. Do some things that are going to involve the family as a family unit. I told one of my Bible study partners that part of my hope for our country during this period of time is that people will once again fall in love with their faith and their families as they focus, they shift their focus, not to things that are outside of the home that fill up the busyness of the day, but as they refocus to what takes place within their home.
Well, that's great advice, and hopefully people will avail themselves of that opportunity. But some governors have made that more difficult. Ticketing your neighboring state right there in Kentucky, writing down the license plate numbers of people who attend drive-in Easter services. As you watch the assault on the First Amendment, what goes through your mind as a sitting United States senator and a person of faith?
When I heard that, I thought, why would you have a problem with people going in a car to sit in a parking lot in their car and listen to a sermon? They are not passing the peace. They're not passing the offering plate. They are in their car. And I just thought that was a little over the top. My hope is that sheriff will reconsider, that the governor will reconsider. Quite frankly, I think that as we get to the April 30th deadline, it is time for us to look at parts of the country where you are not experiencing the outbreak with COVID. You know, I've got counties in Tennessee that have no COVID cases, or counties that have only a few, a handful, single digits. They haven't had one in weeks, a new one in weeks. And those areas need to be able to open back up and go back to work. And I think different areas of the country will open up very soon. You have different industries like construction, manufacturing, government offices that need to get back open and the rest of the economy come online.
Well, let's talk about that date, the hopeful date of May 1st. States like yours, the models, at least the public models that we've seen of projections that sort of led to this shutdown, had Tennessee being hit really hard. but it didn't come to pass, thankfully, for whatever reason. Yet you've been treated as though you're New York. Nebraska has been treated like it's New York. California, with double the population, has 1/10 the fatalities, you know, luckily and thankfully out there. When it comes to reopening the government, should New York be treated differently than Tennessee and Tennessee differently than Michigan as governors would like? Or it seems as though the media is trying to tell everybody we can't reopen the country as if what goes on in Tennessee is what goes on in Newark, New Jersey, is what goes on in Cleveland, Ohio. I want to see your vision of where we go next, because I know everybody's itching to find out where we go next.
They are. And we have to back it up just a little bit and say the rescue plan, the $2.2 trillion that we passed, that was to rescue the economy and bridge it to the point that we can hit the restart and move to recovery. And different areas are going to be ready for that restart at different times. And the governors and the mayors of the counties, mayors of cities, are going to know when they can begin to bring different parts of the economy back online and have people practice social distancing, wear masks, wear gloves. Hospitals, we've got hospitals that are completely empty, and they need to be able to go back to doing appointments, doctor's appointments. They need to go back to doing surgery, people that have been waiting for hip replacements and knee replacements. And listen, there are models that are out there. Cancer patients have continued to receive their therapies. So have renal disease patients. So there are models and there are ways that we can say, how is this healthcare being delivered and patients being protected? Let's put that to work and get these hospitals back online to doing their surgery, whether it's taking a floor where you have non-COVID patients or it's taking a wing of a hospital. Let's bring this back to productivity. What we also need to do is look at the industries that are going to in different parts of the country, and the governors and the mayors are going to know this. And they're going to be able to say, we have, like with us, with auto manufacturing, a lot of these plants, and I was talking to a plant manufacturer, a plant manager yesterday, they already wear hats, gloves, eyewear, and most employees wear a mask. And that is something that they have. They are ready to sanitize that plant one more time and bring people back. So governors are going to set the standard of what that clean environment would be. And as soon as that can be met and people want to begin coming back to work, I think they ought to be able to go to work. Here is what we know. We know that people desperately want to go back to work. They are protesting in different areas of the country, trying to get back to work. I just got a text from a friend, Chris Jansen, my buddy, country star, has written a song about getting back to work. And he says, that is from the heart. And people want to do this. So when they're ready to go and it is a safe environment, get them back to work. We know that depression is up, that people, the calls to suicide prevention lines, those are up. We know that poverty causes death also. And while we mourn every single life that has been lost through this pandemic, we also know that there is death and suffering that takes place from that loss of livelihood. And this is why, Derek, I think we have to hold China accountable for what they have done to us.
Absolutely. I want to talk about that. How does something like that look? We owe them, they hold a lot of our debt. They want to be a player on the world stage. They want to be a player militarily and economically on the world stage. There are many ways to punish them or to at least make them make the world. We don't have the only claim. The whole world right. has a claim against them. What kind of maneuver against China could there be? Is it strictly a United States move? Do we try to get our allies together to do it as a bloc? Because we don't want to provoke a war, obviously, with China, but we can't let them go off scot-free. We have to find that middle ground. Where do we take the lead in the world against China, or do we say, look, you have $5 trillion of our debt, cost us $4 trillion, we now owe you a trillion. Where do we go with this?
Well, I think there are several things that we can do. First of all, a good idea when we go back the 1st of May is to pass Senate Resolution 553. I have it in the Senate. Jim Banks has it in the House. And this says China caused this. They lied to us. They hid the information. They have not been transparent. They tried to blame it on the U.S. military. They tried to oust reporters from China. They're trying to sanitize postings from online. They have so many human rights violations around this. But it sends the message to China that we, the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House, realize they did this. And this campaign of intimidation that they are practicing, they have written my office, calling me out, trying to get a message. They have blocked me on Twitter. The Chinese Foreign Ministry blocked me this week. I mean, they are after me because they don't like what I'm saying, because I'm speaking truth. And now the world knows that Wuhan, China is where the COVID-19 originated. That now is accepted. So we pass the resolution. We move secondly to asking China to waive the $1 trillion worth of debt that they own, that they hold of ours. Then the third thing, let's end these Confucius Institutes that now teach Chinese culture and studies in so many of our universities. That would be a very positive step. Let's also reevaluate the role that China has with the World Health Organization. And thank goodness for President Donald Trump having the guts to withhold the funding to the World Health Organization while we investigate what happened.
It's not just, though, the World Health Organization. China has its tentacles in a great many things. They're on the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, which is hilarious. They are a member of the World Trade Organization. They have permanent normal trade relations with the United States. These are the things that they really, the other things are about saving face in a lot of ways, but trade, they really desperately care about. I remember during the Clinton administration when permanent trade relations, normal trade relations were, should we go as far as revisiting their membership in the WTO and the permanent normal trade relations in the United States?
We should revisit every bit of it, whether it's the WHO, the WTO, whether it is their presence with the UN Human Rights Council, which what they've done to their people with this COVID-19, plus what they do to the Uyghurs every single day, is something that should cause people to say, wait a minute, maybe China should have to change the way they act before they do that. So reevaluating their participation in all of these global entities.
Senator, what is it about China? Is it just the sheer numbers that is so alluring to American politicians and American businesses that they can look past or look around all of the problems that China causes, that China inflicts on its own people and on the world? They just see 1.5 billion people, markets. Is it really that they're blinded by the bottom line?
I don't know what, for many people, the attraction is. I've been on China's case for years. And for me, it started with intellectual property and the way they would just steal the intellectual property of a lot of our entertainers and our creative community. And then working on the technology issues. And when I was in the House chairing Communications and Technology in leading the effort to block Huawei from selling in the U.S. or selling to our allies or being used by the U.S. military, bringing the awareness to how China was building a spy network off of Huawei and off of all of these apps like TikTok. And then, of course, pharmaceuticals and the pharmaceutical manufacturing. And I've got the legislation that would incentivize bringing that pharmaceutical manufacturing back.
What that's hugely important. How do we incentivize the not only the manufacturer, the assembly of the actual pills, but the ingredients in it? It's a big supply chain that we have to sort of reinvent from scratch here.
You're exactly right. It does have to be rebuilt. And the way we are doing that is with grants. And Senator Menendez, this is a bipartisan bill. It's the SAMCX, Securing America's Medicine Cabinet, and putting together a grant pool so that universities can partner up with pharmaceutical companies and then bring some of that manufacturing back, advance manufacturing policies around these active pharmaceutical ingredients. They're called APIs. And then we would incentivize, we would work with the administration on a rule set that would incentivize companies to move back some of that API manufacturing to U.S. shores. So, because this is a national security issue. And I'll give you an example. February 27th, we asked for an API only manufactured in China, and we needed it for a testing, making and testing a vaccine on the COVID-19. China said, we might not give that to you. Well, eventually they relented and did, but what if they had chosen to not give that to us? What if they chose to just say, you can't have it, we're the only source on the face of the earth, and you've got to meet our terms if we give that to you. We do not want the Communist Party having that kind of sway over us. So let's begin the process of incentivizing these companies to come back. And I know Larry Kudlow, who is the economic advisor, has talked some about this week. I haven't spoken with him yet on the issue. I am going to serve on the president's task force to reopen the economy. I think looking at those incentives, looking at regulatory relief that will get the costs down, and then encouraging these manufacturers to bring this manufacturing, not only for pharmaceuticals, but for other essential components of our supply chain, like electronics, like healthcare products, some of the PPE, like telecommunications products. You've got a whole range that are essential components, and we need to bring every bit of that manufacturing back.
Part of the reason we lost manufacturing is not just that it's cheaper to make it over there. It's that our government, state, local, and federal makes it more expensive to manufacture over here. Is there an appetite in our government to sort of unkink the hose even a little bit and allow more of the free market through? And also, are Americans just going to have to get comfortable with the concept that we might have to pay a little bit more to have the security of being able to take care of ourselves in certain industries?
I have a lady in Tennessee who called me last week, and she said she had been to the grocery store and she picked up everything to see where it was made before she put it in the cart. I think people are willing to leave China-made garments and consumables on the shelf and buy something that is made in the USA. I've never seen such an appetite for it. I also think this is the perfect time to exercise some regulatory relief. And I so appreciate President Trump. Look what happened when he said, all right, you agencies, you need to get to work on this with the testing, with getting some of the PPE out and about. Well, the process was moving a little slow for Trump time. So what did he do? He called in the private sector And he said, okay, we have to get the job done. Donald Trump knows how to make a decision. And certainly he did a good job of doing that to bolster our response and our preparation in the COVID-19 crisis. Now, if you can begin to get rid of some of the regulations at the FDA and the CDC and the NIH and push forward with antivirals, push forward with clinical trials, push forward with the approval process, and you're doing that in a time of crisis and you're getting a better result and a more timely result, don't you think that maybe that should apply to all the other times that people are bringing things forward? Why do they need the weight of the federal bureaucracy? I will tell you, I think that one of the things we have seen, and it doesn't matter if it's pharmaceuticals or PPE or finding the antiviral, finding the vaccine, or if it's something dealing with telecommunications, what we have seen is you can indeed speed up decision making, and we can have people in the federal government exercise good judgment and provide good advice. And it doesn't all have to be done by committee. So we can speed this process up.
I worked for Grover Norquist at Americans for Tax Reform 2008 to through 2010. I believe that's where I first met you at the Wednesday meeting one time. And they have been compiling a list of state and federal regulations and laws that have been waived in order to facilitate the response to this. It's up over 250 across the state and across the country.
Right.
Is there... there a chance that we can look back at this and say those should never have been in place in the first place? Maybe we can get a smaller government out of this.
Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing? We have got to find some savings because of the $2 trillion that we have spent and the trillions of dollars of cost in these loss of precious lives and livelihoods. And wouldn't it be wonderful to say the lessons learned have taught us that we do not need this amount of governance at the federal level, at the state level, at the local level? You know, we worked just fine without it during the crisis, and we can probably do just fine without it going forward.
We can make a great case, but you have colleagues on the other side of the aisle who that's their bread and butter. That's their power. Senator Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in your chamber, the upper chamber there, blocked last week a call for a unanimous consent of the expansion, another $250 billion in the paycheck protection money there. That's now out of money as we speak. Nancy Pelosi has her wish list of things that if you're going to save small businesses, which for my money, if you're telling people we're going to get through this tunnel, you got to make that light at the end of the tunnel as bright as possible. And keeping those small businesses able to have a job for them at the end of it is wildly important for all the reasons we've discussed to this point. Are we going to get more money in that fund? And how much compromise are you going to have to make for something that's been so important so far with Democrats? And how far are you willing to go? Another $25 million for the Kennedy Center, $10 million for a statue of Nancy Pelosi. I mean, what do they want? And why isn't just helping the small businesses enough?
Why isn't doing the right thing enough? Which it should be. It should be. And what they're doing, I think, is... holding hostage small businesses. And I had a call right before I got on the phone with you. I had a call from a small business owner in Tennessee, and he is one of these great guys who is a serial entrepreneur. Great guy. He had just gotten a call from his banker. And this guy is trying to keep 5 or 6 different businesses going. And he is in the queue. He is waiting. And his banker called him and said, hey, we just got the notice. that they had had to close the window on this because the fund is out of money. This guy is distraught. And the emotion that was in his voice and hearing him stifle a cry was just almost too much. He has worked all of his life to build these businesses, to provide these jobs. He thinks of these employees as his extended family, and he is heartbroken. He is absolutely heartbroken. And the fact that they will not say, I mean, it's like it's a poker game for them or something, and that we'll give you this, but we got to have this. Well, let's address these issues one at a time as they come to us. And let's do what's right for the American people. This rescue plan is there to bridge them to the point that we can restart this economy and then move to recovery. Why do you not want to bridge these small businessmen and women from a shutdown that was forced on them to the point that they can restart this business? Why do you find that offensive? Why do you not want to do that? It is incomprehensible to me.
You have no answer.
Completely disgusting.
It seems like pressure should work on them, but I don't know where their pressure is coming from, because this is, again, life is about priorities, and your choices reveal your priorities. And for my money, the American people, the small businesses, the heart of our economy, don't seem to be theirs.
I am baffled by this. I mean, these are people who are saying, we want to work. We want to do the right thing. You ask us to shut our doors, to do our patriotic duty. We've been strong through this. We are hanging on by a thread. And you're going to let this window close on us and take away our version of the American dream so you can play politics. And if that's what Nancy Pelosi is trying to do, if that is what Chuck Schumer is trying to do, they need to have a long, hard discussion with themselves when they look in the mirror tonight.
Senator Marsha Blackburn, I asked you for a half an hour. We're at it. I appreciate your time. As we say goodbye, though, there are now, with the new unemployment numbers, 21 million Americans in the last 3 weeks or so out of work. I just ask you for a final message to them, if you don't mind.
Oh, I just, my heart breaks for everyone. As you're fighting to keep businesses open and you're fighting to keep your jobs and you're desperate to get back to work, we're all in this together. Stay strong in this. Know that we are working to get unemployment and small business loans and all of these components to you so that you can keep that job. And just to know, we are the United States. We are made in the USA. And we are going to keep up this fight for faith, family, freedom, hope, and opportunity every single day. Stay in touch with us. You'll find us Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. As soon as we know something, we'll be getting the info out to you. Sure do appreciate you guys. Thanks, Derek.
Thank you, Senator Blackburn. Thank you guys for listening, watching, tuning in, telling a friend. Have a safe, great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday. Bye-bye.